G'day, team. Welcome to another instalment of the U Project. Hi, Melissa.
Hello. How's it going?
Oh, gosh. And take two. No, we're good. We're good. You and I haven't done a podcast for a little while. We'll try that start. Have we?
No, it's been probably a week or so.
There's been a lot of Tiffany, not a lot of you.
I know.
What have you been up to? Let everyone know.
Just working on a few things behind the scenes, really.
That's your standard answer. We need more. That's your fucking go-to. Bits and pieces, few things behind. What have you been working on specifically?
Well,
you're not a fucking government agent, right?
Maybe I am. We have a few events that are now live, which is exciting. So I've been working on some stuff for those behind the scenes. Mm. And we're going to have a new education platform happening and tweaking some things that people won't necessarily see from the front end, but will hopefully help to streamline things for us at the back end.
Well, while we're in, I didn't plan to do this, but I'll save us chucking an ad at the start. Why don't you tell people the two programs that we've got coming up, and while they're captivated...
Sure. So the first one is the Body Project, and that is a 3-hour workshop. These are both online events, by the way. So the Body Project is a 3-hour event happening on Monday, the 1st of February. That is available both online, and also if that's, say, not in your time zone, doesn't suit you, you've got something on that night, it's also available as a recorded version as well. And then we've also got happening starting the 15th of February, we have the U Project Mentoring Program. So that's going to be 12 weeks with you, 2 hours each Monday night, and it's going to be a lot of fun. And hopefully people will get a lot out of it.
Oh, well done, you. Absolutely no prep and no forewarning, and you did beautifully. So Monday night starting on the 15th, isn't it?
Correct.
15th Feb through to the 3rd of May, Q&A, interaction, lots of different head stuff, mind stuff, body stuff, emotional, psychological, sociological, all the components of being human and trying to figure out and navigate the human experience. Speaking of humans, we have a third one on the call. Hello, Bobby Cappuccio.
Hey, Melissa.
Hey, Bobby.
I've missed Melissa. I'm sorry. I just saw an opportunity. I went for it.
Yeah. Well,
we miss you too, Bobby.
Well, you can't miss me because we fucking talk 20 times a month. So where are you?
I'm in San Diego, which is right now the land of sunshine and sheltering in place. It's very exciting.
Is it as we know that there's a fair bit of mayhem in general, but California is probably at the top of the mayhem in terms of states. How does San Diego compare with LA at the minute in terms of, you know, lockdown and restriction?
It's pretty much about the same. Right. Everything's pretty much locked down. We opened up for a little bit, cases spiked, then we shut down. I'm just hanging out in my garden. I think LA is ahead of us in cases. But, you know, it's not lack of, I mean, I don't know. I don't know what the appropriate comment to say on that is. It's a mess.
All right. So what are you doing in San Diego? And I saw on LinkedIn the other day that you got a new job. Tell us a little bit about that, and tell us a little bit about what you're up to, and then we'll dive into our chat.
Well, the new job's actually an old job. I just suck at social media. So it takes me about 6 months to update my profile and figure out like what the hell I'm doing with my life. I'm working with all the school districts in San Diego County in the States and Riverside County. That's both, you know, just not to be presumptuous, that's both located in the West Coast, California.
Yeah. And what's your role? Like, what do you do?
I'm the director of coaching. So I direct coaching. I'm training up a brilliant team. Like, I've been so lucky, God, from Singapore. I think like it was a weird kind of analogy I came up with on a call the other day, not to compare the people in Singapore to her, not to not compare them to her. Do you remember Weird Science from the 80s?
The movie?
They constructed their perfect woman. And it came
that
out
hot lady in the laboratory.
Yeah, Kelly LeBrock, as it would be. I said, you know, if I had a computer program and I could design my perfect team, like it would be like the team I had like in Singapore. not Kelly LeBrock. I don't want to confuse anybody, but I had this amazing team of individuals. And then I come over here and, you know, it was a lot of adjustments, a lot of growing pains. And now again, I have this incredible team of trainers, therapists, medical doctors that I'm developing to coach, empirical based coaching. It's going to be pretty needed out here right now. A lot of people, especially in the school districts, I should say, especially, there's so many industries that are struggling and they're taking care of everything and everyone else. So their self-care and their mental health is critically important.
So we have a lot of people listening to you right now who are in management or leadership and lead teams and lead people and, you know, spend their working life interacting with other, you know, personalities. What made your team in Singapore so amazing? What was it that, was it about the dynamics? Was it about the people? Was it about the culture? What was it?
I would say yes. It was about all of the above. I think what I noticed was authenticity. Authenticity is utilized so much. And I think it's becoming an overused word, like be authentic. Well, what exactly does that mean? And I think when your intentions are completely congruent with your behaviors, that to me is what shows up as authenticity. And it's when, for me, what makes a really great team, yeah, you're there to make a living. I understand that. But beyond making a living is this compulsion, this sense of responsibility to make a difference as well. And every single person on that team, and it's rare because, you know, sometimes you have one or two where it's like, okay, one of these kids is not like the other. And we didn't have any of that. As a matter of fact, when we lost a couple of people because of conflict of interest, like, you know, like one was, you know, pursuing a goal in academia, so she couldn't work on the team full time anymore because of just issues without getting into that. We lost her and she was amazing. And then, you know, you lose somebody else and you got to bring on new people. It's like, now I've got to be very careful who I choose because the interpersonal dynamic of this team is what makes it so great. And so I hardly interviewed. I just spoke to them as a filter and I threw these people out amongst the team. I was like, you guys decide. So I watched how they interacted with everyone else and I let the team make the final decision. And these people that we brought on, one of them just got promoted. The other one is equally a legend and I'm really fortunate. It just worked out really well.
It's really interesting when you're building a team and you're trying to figure out who you're going to work with and who, you know, when you look at bringing somebody in, even, you know, as you know, over the years, well, all of my gyms, I employed a lot of people. I had full-timers, part-timers, casuals. I had a range of office managers, center managers, you know, accountants, PAs, lots of people. And it's so much about, sometimes it seems anyway, for me, it was so much about just finding the right person versus the right academic background, the right skill set, the right qualifications, the right work history. All of those things mattered. But sometimes you'd sit with somebody in an interview and you'd think, well, this person seems amazing, but there's something that, I don't know, energetically, I'm not buying it. Or I don't, you know, they seem really well qualified. They seem really capable, I guess, but there's something that perhaps is telling me maybe interview a few more people. And then I would meet other people where I had this happen probably 5 or 6 times where I would just over the years, so it's not like it happened every week, but over 25 years, this happened a few times, a fair few times, I would meet somebody and they would just have incredible people skills and charisma and they were just good humans and they were a bit funny. And they seemed to be the real deal. And whenever I saw them, they would be the same. And I actually poached about 3 or 4 people from hospitality, waiters and waitresses, yep, who were just amazing with humans. And I said to them, if you ever want to be a trainer, I'll pay for your accreditation. I'll pay for your course. I ended up doing that quite a few times just because they were the right people. They didn't have a whole lot of knowledge or understanding initially. They had basic, but they went and trained. They went and did their you know, their prerequisite kind of qualifying and insurance and all of those things. And all of them were great. Mm-hmm. They were really great trainers just because while their academic and their, I guess, their anatomical and physiological knowledge was base and it was growing and building, but what they had was this amazing ability to create connection and work with others and have good energy. So
yeah, don't try to put in what's left out. You know, what knowledge and skill sets can be taught. It's the things that can't be taught that you want to hire on because you can build on that. So when I was working as the head of fitness and probably education, I don't even remember what my official title was in Gold's Gym. I started out at Gold's Gym chain. When I left there, I went into David Barton Gym in New York City on the Upper East Side, and realizing that I might be a little bit out of my element being head of fitness for that company. It was a very different dynamic. And also being upfront about what I don't know, I sat down with David and I asked him, I said, what are one or two things as leadership in fitness that if I do exceedingly well, you know, it's not only going to support my career, but it's going to support the team, the member, and the organization as a whole. And he just looked at me. He gave me this look like, and he just nodded his head. And he just sat with it for a couple of seconds. It seemed like 12 minutes, to be fair. And he said, two things. I want you to hire amazing trainers. He's like, I want you to become a connoisseur of talent, like a sommelier is a connoisseur of wine. And I said, wow, that's eloquent and dramatic at the same time, but he was spot on. And they said, and then I want you to train them. They said, oh, when you're done with that, I want you to train them and train them and train them. And he was dead serious. He was like, those are the two things you need to do as leadership, because if someone fails, you either hired the wrong person or you hired the right person, which means you failed to give them the tools and resources to succeed. Like Frank Napolitano used to say, he was the, he's had an illustrious career in fitness. So I think his last role was president at 24 Hour Fitness. He said, if you're any damn good, it's all your fault. So if somebody doesn't work out, it comes down to your fault as leadership. For me, the big three, there's a whole list of things you want to hire. You want to profile your A players and say, okay, well, what are the intrinsic attributes that make an A player an A player? But the big three for me is unbridled enthusiasm about some aspect of what it is they're doing and why they're doing it. Criteria number two is aptitude. I'm not so concerned with what it is you know. I'm more concerned with what you're capable and willing to learn. And is that cohesive with the culture? Is that cohesive? Is it on brand, if you will? And the third thing is, there's going to be something a little bit weird about you. I don't mean like serial killer bizarre. I'm talking about there's got to be a quirk in your personality. Like you said, you've got to be funny. You've got to be fascinating. I don't know. Maybe you geek out, but if there's not the weird factor, you're not going to create an interesting dynamic. When I throw you into that chaotic mix of a culture of people who are highly serious, highly engaged, highly dedicated to learning and development, you're not going to make my team a little bit more interesting. People look at that like, oh, that's a little bit weird. Well, how many people, honestly, if you're sitting down and you're in an HR office and Elon Musk walked in, or Richard Branson for that matter, and sat down for a job interview, not like they would, but if they did, how many of you would hire them? A lot of people would probably pass, because people who are extremely innovative and driven, you know, you're gonna strike people as weird on some level or another. Yeah. And I think that weird factor is beautiful. And in the right culture and the right mix, it's magnetic when you put it together in a cohesive team.
Do you have a protocol for finding those people? I know for me, it's been a little bit intuitive. I've done it well sometimes and terrible other times. And, you know, with like Melissa started working for me, just doing bits and pieces 10, was it 10 years ago?
Something like that. Yeah.
When you were 22, I used to call her 22 just cause she was so young. I didn't call her Melissa. I just called her 22. And, that's why I know
she was legally allowed to work, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But you know, like what's funny labor. Is what's funny what's funny is that, like, in 10 years, we've never had an argument. You're 32 now, aren't you?
Correct.
Yeah. Like, we've never had an argument. We've never, you know, there's never been a problem. And, you know, just finding people that you can work with that have similar kind of perhaps values or heading in a similar direction or have a similar fascination about similar things, not that you need to be the same, but on the same page in some way. And then trying to, you know, it's like a lot of the things, in fact, nearly everything that Melissa does now wasn't what, well, in some ways, but a lot of what you do now, correct me if I'm wrong, Melissa, is not what you trained for.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, you know, running events and podcasting and editing. And I mean, you did do a business / psych degree, of course. But yeah, so, but it's finding the right people. It's finding that, for me, it's about finding the right people who really want to be part of, you know, in my case, what you're doing, who buy into your vision, and who really want to be there. Because if people come to me with the right thinking, that is, you know, that the thinking that's going to work in this context of where we're going and what we're doing, and the right attitude and the right intention and the right energy, then all the rest I can train, as you said before. My dad owned multiple businesses when I was young, and I used to work in his hardware store, and people used to always comment to him, I didn't have much going for me, but what a good communicator his 14-year-old kid was. And that was the only thing that I could do, is I could talk to grown-ups and I could sell and I could create connection and I could be interested in people who were 2, 3, 4 times my age and put them at ease. And Dad used to say to me, you can't go to university and get a personality, you know? And so for me, you know, that was his way of encouraging me.
Well, how much of that was watching Dad be an entrepreneur and that inspired you? And how much of that was just, it was an innate attribute of who you are and just the environment brought it out of you? Like, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I reckon that's a good question. I think, definitely some of each, but I did, of course, you know, when you're a kid, when you're a boy, you watch your dad, you know, you love your mum, but it's a different relationship. And I would watch my dad, and my dad was quite charming and charismatic. And when he was younger, he was great at just building relationships and business and doing all that kind of stuff. And so while I wasn't consciously studying him, I was soaking it all up. And
yeah, you can't help but be affected.
Of course, yeah. And then I think, you know, if I'm being honest, I don't have, as I've said many times on this show, I don't have a whole lot of natural ability, but I think probably one of my few gifts is that I can communicate and think clearly, and I can be in the moment. I'm quite intuitive and instinctive, and I can figure stuff out in real time and manage people and navigate difficult personalities and moments in time. And I've been able to do that since I was young. So that for me, in a career where I'm always around humans and I'm always around, you know, different egos, attitudes, personalities, beliefs, you know, psychology, physiology, culture, is being able to navigate and manage in a nice way and interact and connect with different people. You know, I think a lot of that is instinctive. Some of it is a byproduct of your programming and where you've been, and some of it is teachable.
You know, on that, I want to go back to what you were talking about with you and Mel, you know, not getting, you know, not really having any major conflicts, and which is really intuitive on your part, because you recognize that, you know, she's way smarter than you anyway. So like, why even engage in that? It's a total waste of time. And I think vision is non-negotiable. I'm not convinced about my own beliefs in a lot of areas, but I know vision is non-negotiable. If you don't embrace the vision, you're not going to do well. You're not going to do as well as you could do for the team. Sure, you could tick a few boxes, do tasks fairly well, get a paycheck and go home, And that might not hurt the team, but it's definitely not helping the team to your ability. But you're going to be going through a little bit of quiet desperation. Understanding that the vision is cohesively embraced by every person on the team. I want conflict. Like the other day, I was on a conversation with our director of programming in my company, and we kind of got into a little bit of a conflict. Now, I love this woman. This woman's a big part of why I joined the team that I joined. And we have the same exact vision. And here's this person who she outweighs me by about 20 IQ points. Must be. She's brilliant. And it's almost like I not only appreciate when she sees things differently and fights me tenaciously for her position, because I know we're trying to achieve the same thing. As my partner in the company, I demand that from her. And it's funny because she tells a story of when me and a couple of people that you know very, very well were creating a company in fitness that's now a global entity. I'm not going to mention the name of this entity. And this was early days and she was in the room. We got a hotel room and myself and somebody else in the room were nose to nose screaming at each other. Mm. Now, if you were walking by and you were a guest in the hotel, you'd be like, all right, I think we need to call security. Things are about to get ugly. Well, the person I was nose to nose with is at the time and probably like still to this day, one of the dearest friends I have. We were fighting not over who's right, but what's right. We wanted the same exact thing. We embraced the same vision and there was enough trust and there was enough mutual respect.
Yeah.
And there was enough sense of responsibility that we were going to fight as hard as we possibly could because we had somewhere we needed to get to within that meeting. And there wasn't any room for politicking. And an hour after the meeting was over, we were just like in the pub having beers. And she was like, wow, that's pretty cool. And when that culture of that company started to develop cracks in the foundation, and some of the trust, not between everybody, but between a couple of people, core co-founders started to go away. One of the early symbols of that is everything you would say is, oh, I'll just throw out random names. Oh, John, that's so brilliant. That your brilliance is evident in that comment. Oh, Bobby, your brilliance. It's like, what the fuck are we even talking about? Like, we're ordering lunch, mate. There's nothing brilliant about this. Not everything that we say, we don't have to fucking massage each other. This is getting a little bit creepy. And that was one of the first things where my antenna went up and said, I'm not really sure if we have the same culture. There's a lot of work to be done, but you know, something's rotten in Denmark.
Yeah. It's funny because I know who you're talking about. And that person and I also went nose to nose in New Zealand about,
oh, wow. Maybe that person's just like a real asshole. They seem to be
No. And we were We were actually at a restaurant, he and I having dinner and we were talking about, you know, the way certain things work in the fitness industry. Mm-hmm. And that person had an idea and I had a conflicting idea. We had, we had a lot that we agreed on, but there was this one element and it got really messy. And I'm thinking, fuck, I'm actually on a trip with this guy. I'm overseas. Well, it's not that far, is it, New Zealand? God bless you, New Zealand. But, you know, anyway, it was interesting, but because we both care about each other, we went round in circles for a bit, then mm-hmm. we figured it out. And just like with you, you know, 5 minutes after it finished, it was all good. But you know what I think, and like what we were going to talk to about today, and as we do,
just one thing on that.
Yeah.
Cause we're not talking about the same person, but that person was in the room. So they were one of the core people. Yeah, right. I know exactly who you're talking about, but I've had many, that's almost our normal mode of conversation. And we've gotten into so many fights over the years, but the fights were not against one another. It was almost on behalf of and in service of one another, where we see something differently, but we're not only trying to synergize ideas to grow a company, I'm taking a stand for you. And you're taking a stand for me, and not for one second, even if I'm like, all right, this guy is being a complete asshole. There's not one second where love or the friendship or respect is jeopardized. And it's because in part of those like volatile and impassioned disputes that our friendship got even stronger. So not only did that not hurt the friendship, it fortified it, because you need a friend that sometimes it's like, look, I care so much about you and I care so much about what we're doing together. I will take a stand. And even if that means that we have to get into some really uncomfortable conflict, I'm willing to go there. That's missing. Like you can't disagree with anybody in society. Like if I see things even slightly different than you, how could you be so stupid? As a matter of fact, you must be evil. You must be up to something. I can't even believe there are people like you. And we can't synergize. We can't communicate. And that's fragmenting society.
Yeah. Yeah. I say the same thing, and I'm with you. You know, like I call that person that you just described an unreasonable friend. And I think we need unreasonable friends. And by that, I mean people who will love us and support us, but tell us, you know, the truth and or what they believe to be the truth. And they're coming from a place of care and love and respect. And it is, you know, why do you think that we, maybe we've always been like this, but now it's just more obvious because of the accessibility and immediacy and overwhelm of social media, where anybody, you know, it's like you and I, you know, could you imagine you and I 15 years ago when we were just traversing the globe, and 10 years ago for that matter, having a conversation, firstly looking at each other from, you know, two different continents and talking in real time, and then having a chat about shit that fascinates us, and then 10,000 people listening to this chat in the next week or so. Like, it's so inconceivable, but because everyone, if they want, everyone has a platform now, it seems like if you're not sharing my platform or living in my box or sharing my ideology or my thesis, then we can't be friends. Tell me about that.
You know, I think there's so many variables, and I think one of those, like the other day, I was in class with a couple of members of my team, and I was listening to this brilliant lady. She's one of our medical doctors, and she was talking about blue zones around the world. And she was talking about the social cohesion of individuals. I think we get a lot of safety. When we not only get safety, but we're able to mitigate chronic stress through coming in interaction with one another, feeling supported by one another. So our identity, which is who and what we have a greatest level of affinity for, it eases a lot of the psychological and emotional duress that we have to endure otherwise. I mean, life is hard. It's very stressful. When you have a cohesive team and network, when you can even, however that shows up, go to a coffee shop and just hang out and chat, even like go to the pub and see the same group of people, or if you want to play cards, however that shows up for you, when you can kind of do that, it creates safety. And I think we're so connected that we've never been more disconnected, because this does not have the same neurobiological, physiological response as a face-to-face exchange does. So there's a lot of things missing. So who's my identity? So I think I'm grabbing for groups that I feel I can have an affinity for, and whether they're doing it on purpose or not, if you want to create cohesion, you got to create an other. One of the best, I mean, I was talking to a member of my team this morning for a couple of hours. I said, one of the things that I used to do in seminars, and I didn't even realize I was doing this. I was doing it because I believed it. I don't believe it anymore. But I would start out a seminar going, you know, I know a couple of things about the people in the room. You know, this is the first time I'm ever seeing most of you. Some of you, I've seen your faces before. We've been here. But here's the first thing I know about you. you know, you're either at the top 10% of the fitness industry right now, or you're on your way to getting there. You're on your way to becoming one of the top 10% of everyone working in this industry. First of all, where the fuck did I get that stat from? Like, how does that work?
Sounds good though, but don't let the facts get in the way, son. Just keep rolling. Sounds
great. And then it, like everybody is sitting up straight. All of a sudden people are listening because these are people who are coming into a very hard industry. A lot of them are beginning their career, you know, and it's like they're working from like 6 o'clock in the morning until, I don't know, faint o'clock at night. And it's like, holy shit, this is difficult. Like getting a client off the floor. This is like back in the day. And here's this guy going, he knows with confidence. And I was very confident. So I said it emphatically, no doubt in my voice, no hesitation whatsoever. You're at the top 10% or you're on your way there. Because think about this. How many other places could you have been today? Where could you have been? Who could you have been with? You chose to be here. Most people look to the left of you, look to the right of you. Where are your coworkers? They're not here. Because they made different choices than you made. And it would, and I, another thing I know about you is these people are hurting the industry. The reason why this industry isn't being elevated at the rate that it should be is because these people, they could be here. They could be investing in their education. They could be on a mission to elevate the status of their career and elevate members in their organizations along with them, but they chose not to be. So you're making these decisions. You're the reason why the industry is doing all the good things it's doing, but these people are dragging us down. We must never be like them. So instantly, I now have a reputation. I'm in the room with people who are just like me. We're the good people. And now I have an enemy. I mean, seriously, if a trainer that worked on the floor went home and there was no Netflix, but chose to like watch movies all day and eat popcorn, how is that guy really hurting your life? It's not like a mass murderer moved in, a couch potato moved in next door. You've never heard of like, oh my God, you know, like my family was like murdered by a couch potato. They're very safe. They're innocuous types of people. But here I am framing them as like that person's your enemy. And it's like, I believe that so strongly. And then like, it was almost one day. I was like, I'm really full of shit. But it worked because people thought, wow, I'm part of an elite group.
Okay.
They are not like me.
Hit the pause button for a minute because you talk so fucking fast and you say so much that everybody's like, ah, me included. All right. So what you're talking about is living in this kind of echo chamber and and sharing this philosophy and this ideology, we're good, they're bad, we're together, we know, they don't know. I get that. What I want to know is where did the light bulb come from? Where did that moment of self-awareness come from? And then three things. One, where did the moment of self-awareness come from? Two, what do you then do? And three, how do we be more self-aware if that's possible?
Okay, I'm going to be very careful about how I frame this and what I say. I always wanted to get around mainstream self-help speakers, and I started getting around people who did what they did outside of the fitness industry. And I started noticing, oh, this is not a belief. This is a strategy. This is intentional and it's calculated, and it works. It's Hegelian. It's problem, reaction, solution. And you could use that for benevolent or malevolent purposes, but it drives courses and it sells product, and there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, a lot of like I've purchased product and I've gone to seminars that have made a dramatic impact in my life and have given me tools to do the same for other people. But there are certain things that I catch where I'm like, wait, no, I feel like someone's playing a game here. I said, is it possible that what I'm saying in front of the audience, even though I believe it strongly, it's not true? Mm. And I started realizing one thing that happened was 9/11. To me, 9/11, it changed my life for the worst. And then in retrospect, it was one of the most liberating things that had ever happened to me because I lived right by the World Trade Center, very, very close proximity. And it must have probably been like half a kilometer of that. And I got very sick. So for me, I was going through trying to reconcile a lot of trauma. And I felt a little bit like a fraud because although I had worked very hard, here I was a kid that was told, you know, you're basically mentally disabled and you don't have much of a future. And then I'm in a position where I just keep getting promoted and I just keep thinking somebody's making a mistake. So I need to work very hard to live up to the person these people believe I am. Otherwise, I'm going to be found out. And I turned to a lot of self-help. And this is not an indictment on self-help, just a certain segment of it, where to me, I said, I'm going to outwork everybody else. And I figured if I would throw myself into my work and be the hardest working person, and just, I took in everything that I was being fed in self-help, some of it very good information, some of it not true when you look at the empirical data, but I accepted it without question. And then and one of the things was, I just was so tied up in my work that it allowed me to escape from my own thoughts. It allowed me to escape from myself and not face things I needed to face. And I became so sick where 3 hours of dedicated work felt like somebody was slicing through my brain with a jagged piece of steel. And that one, it completely destroyed my theory of control, which as long as I'm very assertive and I push and I work harder than everyone else, I'll be okay. I'll be safe. And that worked for a while. It got me promoted. It got me recognition. It also created a lot of consequences, but I dismissed those as being either irrelevant or I didn't acknowledge the effect I was having on people. And then when I couldn't go out and work all day and all night, I went to the UK. I was sent there and we would have bursts of intense work. And then, you know, we'd have like weekends off and things like that. And I had to sit with myself in Northern England and question a lot of things. So that's when a lot of things started becoming apparent. Like, do I really believe this? Is this the person I really want to be? Or is this the person I feel I have to be? And when I get up and I say things to other people, if it's not true for me, what effect is it actually having on them? And then I got into self-help and I started looking at things from both an apprentice and from a student. And I started seeing things. I know I'm not being extremely specific and I'm doing that intentionally, but I started seeing things I just didn't like. It was almost like a card trick where I'm amazed. I want to be, and it's like, oh, I see what you did there. And then I got around people who became like a family and they had a completely different set of beliefs. They had a completely different way of interacting. But what I also noticed is they weren't always striving through this desperation of becoming. They were sitting in a place of being, and they were extremely happy with who they were. And not because of what they were doing or what tapes they were listening to or what agenda they were pushing, but just of who they were being. They had a powerful effect on everyone around. Ian O'Dwyer. So this is someone I can name. Like, Ian became a hero of, he still is a hero of mine, because he doesn't go out and do anything to have an effect on someone. I mean, if you come to see him in his practice, he will intentionally have strategies that he will move, but he's completely present. So him being present and being authentically with you impacts you. I remember being in multiple cities around the world where it's just, get off a plane. I didn't know where I was. And then out of nowhere, Ian shows up at the hotel and instantly it's like, all right, everything's okay. Let's go grab a beer because Ian's here. So he had a very different life philosophy. And I saw the life philosophy that I was pursuing creating a lot of angst in me. And I was kind of like trying to produce through this incredible anger and frustration. And here's this guy who in every area of life that's important to him, he's successful and he's doing it effortlessly because there's no point of discernment between who he is and what he does. He's in a state of flow. And I was like, I want what this guy has. And I got around a whole group like that. You know,
it's so interesting that, you know, everyone that's listening to this right now, we think about, you know, how we see the world and how we, as you said before, the term you used was how you framed things. And we're constantly telling ourselves stories, and we're constantly rationalizing our choices and our behaviors and our outcomes. And, you know, even our story around what is success, even our story around what is right, what is moral, what is immoral, what is good, what is bad, what is my purpose, what is not my purpose. And, you know, so if we have over time 10,000 people that listen to this episode, for example, there's a fair chance that none of those 10,000 or none of you 10,000 listeners will have an identical experience to another listener. Might be very similar, might be wildly different, but the impact and the effect and the meaning, you know, is that we are constantly processing the world around us and people around us and situations and opportunities or problems or events or circumstances or government or corona or weather or, you know, 9/11 in your case, or and we are, you know, this is back to that duality of the human experience, external world, internal world. And we kind of grow up in this paradigm of success looks like this. And that's what you're taught and told and trained. And, you know, depending on your family or your environment or your situation, religion looks like this. And marriage needs to be like that. And this is how relationships work. And this is how you do leadership. And this is how you do, you know, health. And this is, and then we grow up and we, you know, here we are all right now in this moment in time, whether you're, you know, us three on the call or somebody listening at this moment in time relative to when you hear this, and you're the byproduct of all of that. And there's all of this, you know, all of these stories that we're not even aware of. There are all of these hardwired beliefs and traits and, you know, the way that we process every moment in time. And, you know, to be able to, and we were going to chat today about metacognition and we might get there, it doesn't matter too much, but thinking about thinking is, you know, what we're doing sometimes is in the middle of the mess and the mayhem and the good and the bad and the busyness and the chaos and the box ticking and the high performing and the hustling and grinding, what we're trying to do sometimes is figure out who we are in that. And what do I really think? Like, what do I, not what have I been told to think, not what am I expected to think, not what do they want me to think, what do I believe, not what am I expected to believe or told or trained? And it's because it almost becomes indistinguishable, that programming, from our ability to think freely and critically. And I know for me, and I've mentioned this before, but growing up, you know, in a certain kind of theological construct of Catholicism, which was not just a casual thing, that was very, for me, very dictatorial. I only went to Catholic schools. I even went to a Catholic university. I only had Catholic friends. We constantly had priests and nuns in the house. It was, and so then you know, by the time, even now, you know, there are times when I will think a certain way or say a certain thing, and there's still an element of discomfort or guilt there because of my programming. And, you know, so mm-hmm. to be able to have this awareness of, like, you growing up feeling like the dysfunctional, broken kid that was worth nothing, because that was sadly kind of the message that you received directly or indirectly. And so there's this compulsion in you that you have to show people and prove yourself and work three times harder than everybody to be able to play in the same space.
Mm-hmm. Also, acceptance for me was, it was a condition of my survival. Like, there were many times where I came very close to getting killed. And one of the games that I would play, and I didn't realize it was a game I was playing as a kid, is trying to anticipate, okay, who do you want me to be right now? Like, what are your beliefs? And I'll see if I can mirror these beliefs, because then you're not going to try to kill me for the next couple of hours at least. Because because my strategy was always like, you know, my life plan was always 2-3 hours ahead. So it was very moment to moment. I believe I've carried that at points in my career, if I'm honest, where I should have been looking to be a contributing member of a team, and I was, but I was always also looking for a family. And because families show up as a certain archetype to me, there was an element of me seeking approval. And a lot of times that puts you on a path that's not congruent with what you're suited for or what you truly want. And it creates this emotional duress, and it causes a lot of disappointment. I think when you don't get accepted, because, you know, not everybody's going to accept you. You know, for me, I saw that as a life or death level threat. You know, so it's hard to ask yourself, what are my true intentions in this? Because you have stories, but then you have stories about your stories. So Eric Berne, he wrote the book, Games People Play. And I think he was the first person, you know, a lot of people have talked about this and used this word, but he introduced, you know, the notion of running rackets. So you have these outward socially acceptable intentions behind doing what you're doing. But then underneath that, you have the real nature of business, you know, the real intention there. So, you know, you pretend like, okay, I'm a team player, but underneath that, it's like, no, I require a certain level of acceptance because that's been conditioned into me for multiple years. And I was going through a training with a company I was working with, and it was kind of in depth. And the leader of the group said something. He said that you're either your originating intention or you're your shadow. I was kind of Jungian. And what's the difference between originating intention and an intention? Well, we have all these contrived intentions, like social expectations, like you were talking about, you know, Catholicism and, you know, being around the priests and the nuns, and there's certain intentions. So you have intentions, but they're not originally yours. They're a construct of whatever culture you're growing up in and all of the influences and triggers within that environment. But then you have this, you kind of have this deep visceral thing that you gravitate towards. So if you look back and say, well, what was the best time in my life? There were elements there. There were people that were there. There were things that you were doing. There were things that made that thing the best time of your life, or at least how you remember it anyway. Who cares? Because you're selectively remembering the most salient aspects of that. And there are things that you hold sacred. And how you know a true core value, how you know an originating intention, is that thing that you really, really want for yourself, you want for everyone else around you. And it's when you have something you really want for yourself, but you don't want it for others, you're playing a power game. It's manipulative. It's inauthentic. Like if you're horrified at the thought of injustice when you're suffering from injustice, but seeing other people go through acts of injustice, you rationalize it. Somehow they're deserving of it because they have characteristics in their group that's different than your group. That is a racket. That's a game you're playing. So you're either this originating intention or you're your shadow. And the way they described the shadow was interesting. They said, what do you say to yourself when you know you're about to be betrayed? Not like somebody's going to do something accidentally and disappoint you. They are someone you really trust, you really love, is about to intentionally betray you.
Wow, that's such a good question. Sorry, that's such a good question. I've never thought about that, but I've had that happen many times. Okay, keep going. I'm sitting up straight.
And this guy used to yell at us in the room, because then you would see all the rackets come out. You would see all the games we're playing. It's like, well, I say to myself that I know that, you know, they're trying to do the best they can. And maybe it's like, shut up. What do you really say to yourself? Yeah. Like, let's get honest, not the Disney version. Stop trying to look good in front of the group. That's not the game we're playing. And I know what I said. And I said this at a corporate meeting, which was kind of shocking. But when I said it out loud, I was like, oh, that's my shadow. And then when you act from that position to defend and to counter respond to that level of injustice, that level of betrayal, that's your shadow. And a lot of times we're going out, we're pretending to have these altruistic intentions, but we're acting from the shadow. We've been threatened on a level that is deeply personal and deeply visceral.
It is, you know, because we kind of look after ourselves first so often, and because there's, you know, because fear is such an influence and ego is such an influence and the self is such a dominating presence, it is hard to live that altruistic existence and to have a purpose bigger than yourself. And all of these are fluffy concepts, I know, but you know, it's just a constant work. But I wanted to ask you, without you elaborating too much, but when you were talking 5 or 10 minutes ago about, you know, avoiding essentially being killed and we won't go back over it, but you've spoken about it once or twice on the podcast, but your childhood, which if you haven't heard, folks, it's a fascinating story, but you were in harm's way when you were a kid a lot, and you're under threat a lot, and you were raised in, you know, less than desirable circumstances. How did you, you know, it feels like for me, you were from a very young age, you know, navigating all of these variables that a kid shouldn't have to navigate, you know, trauma and danger and, you know, violence and, you know, the threat of death or the thought of dying or being killed. How did you cope mentally and emotionally and practically? Did you have somebody that you went to, or was this just you know, developing as you went?
And none of this was strategic. I think a lot of this was just accidental. I engaged in something and it's like, oh, this seemed to help. So Dr. Peter Levine, you know, works with people who have suffered extreme trauma. And, you know, he had said, God, I was talking about this earlier today. Wow. And he said that you can't get rid of trauma by talking yourself out of it. You can't talk away the negativity. Now, reframing your languaging and how you talk to yourself, it's helpful, but it's not sufficient. Trauma works not on a cognitive, but on a deeper emotional and physical level. You know, think sensations, like if, you know, a loud noise goes off and, you know, your dog gets terrified, what are they going to do? They're going to sit there and shake and shiver and work out that trauma on a physical level. And for me, I first started discovering strategies to work out my trauma through exercise. It was like 15 years old, walking into the Y on Coney Island Avenue in Brooklyn and just not knowing what I was doing. It looked like a, you know, bunch of furniture with weight stacks attached to it. You know, I looked around and I found the biggest guy in the gym who had like this body that, like, I wanted to aspire to develop, you know, but he didn't have any legs, but that's okay. He just wore, you know, pants all the time.
Yeah.
And
it was the 80s, typical standard.
His name was Dougie. And he looked just like you thought a bodybuilder named Dougie would look. And I just started asking him questions and he helped me. Couldn't walk for 3 days after my first gym session. So I think, I don't know. I don't know if progression was his thing, but, he gave me some stuff to do and I just started figuring it out from there. And it gave me a focus outside of myself. You know, I started reading a lot. Most of what I was reading and learning about exercise was quite fictitious, but I was passionate about it. I started sharing it with other people. So for the first time in my life, I had value. So for me, it was a physical level first. And then it was the ability to emotionally connect to people because I had something to offer, which nobody ever wanted anything from me because they didn't think I had anything to offer. I was a freak. You know, I was like physically deformed in my face. That amongst many other attributes, I had Tourette's. So I was kind of like this weird, weird kid. And then growing into exercise and fitness as a profession, I got into a highly aggressive work schedule for a lot of different reasons. And that did actually help in some respects because I had no time to focus on me. And the way that I was able to elevate my position in the company was to focus single-mindedly on adding value for other people.
Do you think that for a lot of time, and I think we all do this. I've done it, but you know, it's like we're just creating distractions, you know, to in that, you know, maybe subconsciously you felt that if you were big and had huge muscles and maybe that would help you protect yourself, especially when you're 15 years old. And then you would throw yourself into something, then throw yourself into something else. Do you think that part of that was you not having to feel or think?
I think I've always looked for distractions. I think people do that. And I think everybody to some degree or another does that. And it's okay to be consumed by something. You know, when you're consumed by something, oh, you're obsessed. You know, obsession and passion. I mean, passion, you know, is what you're, what do you love so much? You're willing to suffer for it. You're willing to invest and sacrifice for it. You know, some people use distractions, you know, they turn to drink, and no opinion about that whatsoever. Other people, they throw themselves into their work, which is okay. If you're doing your work because you love it and you can't imagine yourself doing anything else, that's one thing. If you're throwing yourself into your work because you don't want to go home to something, that's quite a different story. So for me, when I was very young, I'm talking about like 10, 12, you know, I threw myself into a lot of alcohol. So one of the things that my parents did not restrict me on, or my adopted and step parents didn't restrict me on, was how much time I spent outside. So I had a curfew for a little while, and then they took that away. As a matter of fact, they didn't want me home a lot of the times. So I was able to stay out unsupervised, and you know, I would just get into fights and drink a lot. And this is as a little kid. And then I just changed one distraction for another. Luckily, as I got older, my distractions were also simultaneously things that I fell deeply in love with. So after a while, I didn't even work for an outcome. I think that's another thing I realized in the midst of the downtime that 9/11 forced upon me, was I'm not working so I can achieve something. I'm doing this because I love doing it. Wow. And so it was very different for me. I thought I should be heading somewhere,
yeah,
but then I realized that's not even important to me.
Such an interesting story, your story. Like what I love about, you know, hearing about what, well, I don't love hearing what happened to you, but you know, you're 10, 12 years old, you're fighting, you're getting in scuffles all the time, you're drinking alcohol, your parents don't want you home, so you're out. But at the same time, you have this fucking amazing mind. And I know you're going to put yourself down because that's your way of deflecting, but I'm not going to let you, so shut the fuck up. But you have this incredible brain.
That's
it. You have this ridiculous memory. You have this unbelievable understanding of, you know, everything to do with human performance and human behavior and neuropsychology and neuroscience. And when did you first read a book? Like, when did you first read a book front to back? How old were you?
Wow. Okay. I don't even know. I must have been very young because I a lot of times if I was just in my room, I would pick things up and just read. I don't think I front to back.
Or just where you started reading by yourself and you just, how old were you?
Probably about same time, 11, 12. I would just pick things up and read them and put them back. I think the first book I remember reading front to back, I was quite old. Relatively speaking, I was 18 and it was Alex Haley's
Roots.
I think it was the biography of Malcolm X.
Right.
Wait, even before that, years before that, it was Catcher in the Rye.
Right. Well, one of the most famous books of all time. And
but that was a school assignment. I don't even know if you can like count that because I had no choice but to read that.
So do you have a photographic memory or an eidetic memory, whatever that is?
No, I don't. I have like a bit of obsessive compulsive disorder. So, and I'm not like, oh, I'm so OCD. OCD is, I've had it to varying degrees, and sometimes it was completely debilitating. It sucked. It's the last thing I would ever want to have, but I would tend to revisit things over and over and over. My memory has been average at best. This past year, I don't even know if I should say this on a podcast. I've been having a lot of challenges cognitively. So it's worse than it's ever been this year. I don't know what that's from. Maybe it's lack of face-to-face communication, lack of the sensory stimuli of being out on the road, but it's been brutal. But overall, my memory's been not the best, not the worst. If I get fixated on something, I would read the same book. Like, even I think it's behind me. I still have this book. Or it's downstairs, but Norkin and Lavangi's Joint Structure and Function. I read that book like 20 times. It wasn't easy reading, but I was just so fascinated with what was it. I went back, this is back in the 1990s. I was a kid, and the presenter, you know, he held it up and was like, I love this book. And he started quoting from the book, referencing the book. I was like, I got to read this book. I read it, and just, so I would just approach things that way.
I've lost
a lot of relationships that way.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Somebody comes downstairs middle of the night. I'm watching Cadaver Anatomy, taking notes. I'm like John Nash. I've got post-its all over the place. It's like, okay, this guy's a weirdo. I'm out of here. Sorry.
What? And not that it matters, because you're in the top five smartest people I know. Why didn't you go to university?
I did go to university.
What did you do?
I didn't do much, and I didn't stay very long, but I did go. I've gone to university my whole life just for an event. And then I'd leave. But so I did go.
It's funny. I hate academic snobbery, which sounds funny coming from me, but I do. I think, you know, experiential learning is the best. I think academia is great and it's important, and we need research and science and study. So don't misquote me, but you know, like, I think experiential learning and what you've done, which is read thousands of books, and you're sitting in a room now with hundreds of books behind you, just your ability to be able to consume things, to read and to see and to remember and to recall and to understand. And I know that you're saying your memory's shit, but if your memory's shit, then I'm a fucking coffee table. Fucking hell. How do you recall, or like, when I talk to you about neuroscience and the brain and neuropsych, I feel like you're the professor and I'm the one who's just starting a course. How do you remember all of that?
Well, I think the first thing is understanding how it is that you learn on a multi-sensory level and pursuing your interests. We have ways that we're taught that we need to learn, and then there are ways we're naturally inclined to learn. So for me, the way things sound, the way they're explained, it not only catches my interest, but there's a visceral sense of pleasure. So I'll have books that I read, but I'll go out and repurchase those same books on audio. And sometimes it's read in this monotone voice and it's completely shit. Other times, like Improv Nation by Sam Walson. Wow. Was that narrated so well? Yes, Please by Amy Poehler. Amy Poehler did such an incredible job. Like, Amy Poehler kept me company on the MRT when I would go all the way to the west side of the country to teach in Singapore. And I had this sense of deep disappointment when that book was finished. It was like, I felt like it was a breakup. So when books are narrated that well, and the content in and of itself interests me on some level, I tend to learn a lot more rapidly. And I again, stumbled into it where, just by nature of what my job responsibilities were, I would have to learn something and not only apply it to the business, I would have to teach it to other people. And when I started teaching to other people, I learned, one, getting in front of a group of people, whether it was five or 500, was terrifying. I would always feel like I wanted to throw up. And when it was over, it was euphoric. It was the most amazing experience in the world. And I also started to realize that I was retaining the things I was speaking about. So for me, it's learning things on a multi-sensory level through listening, through reading, through doing it when that's applicable. I mean, you know, it's kind of hard. Like if you're reading a novel, you know, it's kind of hard to jump into the character. I think there's probably a level of psychosis there, so you don't want to do that. But it
depends on the character, doesn't it? If it's, you know, like Dr. Seuss or something, I'd love to see you fucking in all different colors, just flip-flopping around the neighborhood with a snorkel and some goggles and shit.
Well, one of the most practical books I've ever read was Oh, the Places You'll Go. I was hanging out with my friend Kat on the high street in Kensington, and we popped into Urban Outfitters, and she picked up that book. And she's like, have you ever read this before? Okay, she didn't say it in that masculine, breathy voice.
She sounded like a spy.
Yeah. It's like, I don't know why Kat is like breathy in a trench coat. In my...
why are you all breathy and you're talking about a kid's book? Relax.
She had it underneath her coat. It was just weird.
Yeah, it was in a brown paper bag. You guys were at the back of a toilet. Yeah.
So she said quite normally, in a normal voice, have you ever read this book before? I said, well, I know Dr. Seuss. I thought, what, you taking the piss? She's like, read this book. I want to buy this book for you. I read it. I was like, this really is like a how-to guide of life. But yeah, beyond that, if I can apply something that I've listened to and I've read, and then I could go teach it, and I could saturate multiple learning pathways, it not only helps me retain information, but it makes the information in and of itself enhance my experience of learning. So my highest value, not to go ahead and start promoting things, but Dr. Martin Seligman, who's, you know, one of the fathers of positive psychology, him and his associates have put together the Values in Action survey. So if you go to viacharacter.org, it's kind of a stepping off point where you can answer a series of questions, and they'll tell you based on that point in time, because it does shift, what your five highest values are. And my highest value consistently, because my values have shifted over the past couple of years as I've taken this, which is normal, but my one or two highest values are always appreciation of beauty and excellence. And it, that hit me like, yes, that is what drives me. And my second, you know, highest value is humor. So those things are like what you're learning and what you're doing, I think, has to be connected to your values. Otherwise, you're going to drag yourself kicking and screaming to a destination that you don't want to be in, and you're going to lose a battle, an internal battle against yourself, just through fatigue.
Well, as always, we started this conversation in Melbourne heading towards Sydney. We went via Perth and we ended up in Auckland. So back in New Zealand, like we were at the start of the show. Hello to our New Zealand listeners. You know, New Zealand is number three on our international list now, Melissa.
It's growing, yeah. And
New Zealand has forged ahead of the UK and, of course, the United States. We have, on average, about 14,000 listeners or a bit more in the States.
NZ's just kicking ass in all categories, isn't it?
They are. Mate, if people want to contact or connect or, you know, stay at your joint or spoon you on the couch, how do they do that?
Right, yeah. So you could find me on Facebook. You could find me on Instagram. I'm on LinkedIn, you know, but I mentioned earlier, I only check my messages once every 6 months, so don't do that. I'm in the process of building a website, The Self-Help Antidote. So you'll be able to eventually find me there.
And when are you finally pushing that fucking podcast out of the entertainment nest and into the world so that we can listen to you?
I have a very special guest lined up this Saturday evening.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Well, good. I'm excited. Bobby Cappuccio, thank you for talking to us yet again.
Thank you, Craig. Thank you.
Thanks, Matt. Melissa.
Thank you.